Greetings, and welcome to The Thirsty Mage, the podcast that grew in a time when wandering around aimlessly in a video game was both expected and enjoyable. I am your host, David Lloyd. In this episode, we take a look at the career of Akitoshi Kawazu, the longtime Square developer who doesn't care if you understand what you're playing, and the driving force behind the Saga series. But before we get into our discussion, I just wanted to ask that if you do enjoy the episode, please consider leaving us a review on your podcast player of choice. It helps grow the show and provides feedback to ensure we're providing the best possible experience. So let's introduce who's on tonight's panel. So first up, he is the NWR review editor and gentleman who needs no excuse to play an NES-era RPG, Jordan Rudick.
I spent far too much time today debating with myself whether to keep saying romancing Saga or romancing. And I still don't really have an answer. I'm probably going to switch between the two throughout the episode. So, you know, forgive me in advance, I suppose.
Is there like a deliberate pronunciation? Like, did I miss? Is the name?
I hate romancing Saga. Like romancing. Like, I don't know. Holding it's, that.
You just really hate the patriarchy.
I suppose. Like, I know if it was just romance, you say it that way, but when it becomes romancing, I want to say romancing. I want to jazz it up.
Or Romario?
What? is that?
And of course, like Saga has a uppercase G in the middle of it, so it's Saga. Right.
Saga. Can I just
romancing makes even more sense. Things now. I feel like I'm going to have to find a link and send it to David so it can be put in the show notes. Ray Barnholt of Retronauts and 1UP fame. Also gave me my first freelance assignment about the Virtual Boy 10 years ago, something like that. But he, like, you can go buy a pin that, like, says it's in the font of the logo, and it just says, "I'm Gaga for Saga."
Oh, yeah, I remember. I saw that on Twitter.
I got a pin you can wear. I got to wear that to PAX West next year.
Okay. Yeah, I'll go. I'll find the link, and I'll put it in the chat.
And also joining us is Radio Free Nintendo co-host and man who learned a new language just to play a Kawazu game, Guillaume Vaillette.
Psst, bananas are going around secretly.
Guy, you're not allowed to talk about that on the show. We're going to get in trouble. That's contraband.
I'm so evil. I'm so bad. Banana smuggler. This will make sense at some point, maybe, if we explain it.
To like five of our five listeners who have played the game.
What's funny is after I saw your tweet, and then I was playing Last Story at the same time and realized that I had some kind of banana diversion arrow in my equipment.
Yes.
And I'm like, man, there's something about bananas at Square. Not even Square, because it was a Mistwalker game. Must be an inside joke between Kawazu and Sakaguchi.
Who knows?
And lastly, Nintendo World Report owner and new entrant into the cult of Kawazu, Neil Ranahan.
We'll talk about it a little later. I'm not a new entrant. This is my first time where I'm like, oh, this is who Akitoshi Kawazu is. This is his thing. Saga 3 is pretty cool.
Yeah, it was funny when you were telling me about you couldn't remember which of the legends that you had played, and I was going to say, it depends if you punched one god in the face or more than one god.
I think it was a sequel. Like, I might have the cartridge somewhere, and that would give me closure to this thing that's been kind of plaguing me for the past months and maybe years. Like, because I got a Game Boy. I played Final Fantasy kind of like under the watch of like watching one of my brother's friends play it. And so when I got a Game Boy, I was like, oh yeah, I want to get Final Fantasy games for that. And I got Legend 1 or Legend 2. I know it wasn't Adventure of Mana. Like, that's the one thing that I 100% know. And I did not understand any of it. It was the early 90s, so I had no way to really figure out how to play that game. But I put countless hours into that game and kind of brute forced learned the systems. And I do remember reaching the end and beating a god. But like, this is 20-year-old memories that I don't know. I've tried looking at videos for both games, but they look similar enough that I can't tell the difference.
Well, it seems like you've got the gist of it anyway. It sounds like a Kawazu game.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, that's why, like, playing The Legend of Legacy started to be like, wait, why does this feel familiar? And that's when I realized that I'm like, oh, okay, one of those games that I played when I was a kid was a Kawazu game. Final Fantasy II is still bad, though. It's a bad Kawazu game.
Yeah, I've never really put that much time into it, and I guess I don't really want to.
No, don't bother. I don't think there's very much that's redeeming about Final Fantasy II. I think everything that Quetz is trying a lot of stuff there, and then he would go and do it on his own. And I think when he had that freedom, it was a little bit better. But I think the series has certainly gotten better. I mean, we're going to talk about some more recent entries coming up here. So,
if you were going to play Final Fantasy II, you would need a beer, and I'm pretty sure Neil has one right now.
I actually don't. I'm very tired. So, following up on last episode, the namesake for last episode, Dr. Dazzle, have not been able to find Dr. Dazzle at my local Aldi. So instead, I'm drinking a shitty energy drink from Aldi because I'm very tired. You guys are Canadian, so you must like hockey. I went to a hockey game last night. I saw the Flyers beat the Vancouver Canucks 2-1. With no vested interest in either team. So it was just funny seeing all the Philly fans get really mad about everything that happened at all times. Because, I mean, that's sport fandom. Also, that's Northeastern sports fandom.
Did you get to meet Gritty?
He walked near me, and I wanted to run and hide. Gritty is terrifying.
He is terrifying.
The eyes, the way they jiggle around, like, ugh.
I think you have to be a Flyers fan.
Isn't that every mascot?
Yeah, but there's a special way that he's got like these really haunting googly eyes.
Yeah.
Like Gritty just has a look about him that is like a step above your Philly fanatic kind of weirdness.
He looks like a nightmare creature you might see on something like Sesame Street. But like a very dark
Neil,
version.
Neil, were you traumatized as a kid by the movie Labyrinth or
not as much.
Okay.
I actually, I kind of had a very, like, bad, I guess this is maybe just my, like, acid childhood flashback episode. Return to Oz being on Disney Plus gave me a memory that I'd kind of forgotten of why I was terrified of everything of Wizard of Oz, was because I saw Return to Oz when I was way too young. I basically was just, like, completely petrified of the Wicked Witch of the West and a lot of the other villains from the Oz series, because I saw Return to Oz at too young of an age.
Well, I just see that Guillaume put his description into the notes, and I'm liking the style. It sounds like it has a story to it.
The story is that I'm really tired, and I do have a beer in the fridge, but I had the bright idea of doing some Ring Fit before recording, because I thought that's going to wake me up. Of course, I'm in danger of just crashing. So I bought these non-alcoholic spritzers for Karen because alcohol doesn't really play nice with some medication that she takes. So, but she doesn't like the flavor strawberry, and so I'm stuck with them. So I'm drinking a Casal Domingo spritzer, Zinfandel strawberry blush. It's wretched. It's really bad. Oh my god. I've got only two of these and then I'm good. I don't have to buy them again. But the pear flavor was actually pretty good.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of those things, it's super hit or miss on like the flavor of whatever, like that knockoff spritzer, even like some of the seltzer, alcoholic seltzer stuff is the same way. Where the flavoring could just be abhorrent.
Yeah, well, you know, strawberry, I was really asking for it, you know? Like, I don't think it could have really turned out that well.
Yeah.
How about Jordan? Are you leaving me high and dry on the alcohol tonight?
Well, I think it's surprising that the two people before me have probably disappointed you more with their choices than I'm going to, or I usually do.
Did you find Dr. Dazzle?
I wish. I didn't get a chance to go out and pick up any. I'm just drinking water right now, but I wanted to talk about two drinks that I had a couple hours ago. We went to a Christmas market in Vancouver. It's kind of in the downtown area by the water, and it used to be like a strictly German Christmas market, but it's expanded a little bit more. It's a little bit more diverse, I suppose. You might just call it a European Christmas market now. But at any rate, they still have a lot of kind of German-inspired things. We get bratwurst and stuff like that. So I had an apple cider as one of my drinks, just a hot apple cider with some spice. It was nice. And then I also had something called Kinderpunsch, which is, I guess, like, you would get mulled, like, my wife had a mulled wine, the rest of my family, they were drinking mulled wine. I probably should have had one. At any rate, I tried the Kinder Punch because I had, like, a coupon for a free one. And it was nice, actually. It's kind of fruity. It's got some spices in there, too. I think it had, like, raspberry and blackberry and different things like that. And they serve these drinks hot. Obviously, it's getting pretty cold. It's about, I think it was 2 or 3 degrees Celsius. So it's almost at the freezing point for us. And so it was nice to have some hot drinks there. But, so I had a glass of this Kinder Punch, which was quite good, and an apple cider as well. So, yeah, I don't know that I'm the most disappointing host on the show with my drink choice this week, so I'm happy about that. David, correct me if I'm wrong. Well, if my two choices are appalling to you, then I'll concede it. But
now the Kinder Punch, it has alcohol in it, I'm assuming.
It does not.
It does not.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, it sounds
Kinder,
like,
right? It's meant to be for kids.
I don't know any German, but if I had to guess, I would say it's like punch for babies.
Yeah, like kindergarten, right? It's
right.
The same thing.
Yeah, I assume. I'm not going to look
it's
up.
It's a non-alcoholic punch, I guess. So it's the alternative for the designated drivers or the people who are too cheap to buy an actual drink and just want to use the coupon drinks.
Nice.
I have a Scotch ale. Scotch ale is one of my favorites at the local pub, but I went with a different one just to switch it up a little bit. And this one is an extra strong brewed with honey from Macroquin Flowers. It is a microbrewery in Quebec. It is a hearty 10.8, and it was actually incredibly good, especially for a Scotch ale. It's on the list. I'm going to have it again. It was that good. It had a little bit less bite than the usual Scotch ales I drink, but in a good way. So.
Nice. You're being on brand for the show, David, because you're switching it up tonight, just like Akitoshi Kawatsu switches up the JRPG tropes that we're used to.
Wow.
Nailed it.
Yeah. So I'll just do a brief history if people don't know who Akitoshi Kawatsu is. He is he began with Square back in 1985 with Hironobu Sakaguchi. The two of them worked on the original Final Fantasy. He was, Kawazu was the one that was developing systems in the battle sequence. And then, after they worked on Final Fantasy II, they kind of parted ways. So Sakaguchi went to work on the Final Fantasy franchise and Kawazu started the Saga series. For tonight's podcast, we're actually going backwards in history a little bit because we're going to start off with the review of Romance. Oh, man. You got my
gotcha,
head.
Gotcha, gotcha.
You just put it on his head.
Plan. It was all
Jordan,
his plan.
That was cruel.
It was all planned, right?
Romancing yep. Saga 3. So this just came out on the Switch a week or two ago, I guess, now. And this is what has gotten us, given us Kawazu fever. Because It is a terrific RPG, and we're going to talk a little bit about it. And it inspired us to go back to his old stuff. We'll talk a little bit about Saga 3 at the beginning, and then hopefully we have a Kawazu expert coming in a little bit later, and we'll talk about his old stuff. So maybe, Jordan, if you want to... You were the official reviewer of Saga 3, if you wanted to kick off...
Romancing Saga 3. Originally a Super Famicom game. I think this was maybe mid-90s or something when it came out.
1990, November 95. It actually came out, the remaster came out 24 years to the day.
Huh. Oh, cool. Oh, that's interesting. I think it was a year after Final Fantasy 3/6 came out as well. So it was following that game.
Yeah. The timeline for that would have been, Chrono Trigger and Final Fantasy 3 would have been, or Final Fantasy 6 would have been like the previous two Square games before Saga 3.
Yeah. Final Fantasy 6 came out in Japan in 94.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of funny to get this game last, like players would have already played, you know, very seminal titles of that era, RPGs, in Final Fantasy VI and Chrono Trigger, and then to get something which is, you know, obviously very, very different in Romancing Saga 3, but of course, this is one of the, there's probably already been, what, 5 or 6 Saga games that have already come out. The Final Fantasy Legend games, obviously, that they were known as here, and then Romancing Saga, 1 and 2 coming out before this third one. So it's not like the Kawatsu-made games were an unknown quantity, right? There's obviously a group of people that are interested in these games, and people keep giving Kawatsu the green light to keep making them. So there must be something working out there for him. So the third game, the one we got on Switch recently, was a remaster of Ramon Six Saga 3. It is gorgeous. It's got really wonderful kind of the pixel art, the HD pixel art. And I mentioned in my review, it really does remind me of the art style of Final Fantasy VI, especially the character models and some of the towns you go to. Like you could easily confuse a quick glance at this game as being areas of Final Fantasy VI. Even characters like Sabin, I play the game as Julian, one of eight characters you can choose in this game, and he reminded me a little bit of Sabin. Just some of the actions and the expressions they do are some of the ones that I feel like I've seen before in Final Fantasy VI.
Yeah. I feel like I've seen some of the screenshots, and one of the dudes looks like he's actually the sprite for what's the name of the wild child in Final Fantasy III?
Gao. Yeah, Gao.
It just looks like Gao. Looks like they took the same sprite. Yeah.
So I was just checking the timeline of everything, and there's something. I mean, one, I think that I would not be surprised. I did not do a deep dive into the credits that some of the artists who work on Final Fantasy VI, I feel like they probably worked on Saga 3. But sure. We wound up not really touching on it on the Hodgepodge episode, but I put a couple hours into Trials of Mana the other month. And it's interesting to also look at that Trials of Mana came out 2 months before Saga 3 in 1995. Mm. And it's also the distance from Saga 2 to Saga 3 and Secret of Mana to Trials of Mana, it's almost identical. So like they probably had very similar development time periods and were kind of almost in parallel development. And as far as that same feeling of looking at Trials of Mana and seeing a lot of just that Final Fantasy VI of it all, I kind of felt the same thing, some of the animation in that game. And I mean, that's just Square of that era has a very distinctive style that I think, you know, you have variations in it. Like I think Chrono Trigger's art style kind of stands out from everything, but just the look of everything, there's a house style to it.
No, that's fair. And the concept art is from different... unfortunately, I don't have the Wikipedia page opened up in front of me right now, so I can't... but I know that the character designer is a woman, or maybe two women, actually, for Romancing Saga. And, for Final Fantasy, of course, it's...
I'm probably going to butcher the pronunciation. Tomomomi Kobayashi. She's basically done Saga games. She also helped out on Sonic Unleashed, but let's just focus on the Saga games.
Sure. Yeah.
And just imagine living as a JRPG fan in Japan. Like this is undeniably a golden era of games, right? Just all the ones that we've mentioned so far coming out within 2 or 3 years of each other. I think we already see the Super Nintendo as a JRPG powerhouse in the West, but in Japan, it's double that, right?
There's legitimately an 18-month period where you get Final Fantasy VI, Chrono Trigger, Trials of Mana, Secret of Evermore, Romancing Saga 3, Live a Live.
Yeah, they were on fire.
I'm curious. I know Neil and David, you guys were playing Romancing Saga 3. Like, how far did you end up getting? Or what point of the game are you at right now?
Right now, I'm collecting a bunch of pocket monsters. I got a couple hours into Saga 3 and then Pokemon came out, and that kind of took away a lot of my time. And it's not so much, it's more that I think Pokemon is very good. Stay tuned next month when we talk about that on the Thirsty Mage. I basically got through the prologue and then put another 2 or 3 hours kind of doing some of those quests. But it's something that I really want to revisit. I got to a point where it's basically okay, I can leave this here and not be horribly lost when I come back to it. It's just the open-ended structure of it has a little more guidance than I think I've experienced in... I mean, Saga 2 is one that I suffered through a number of hours of that game, and I think Saga 2 is a bad game. But Saga 3, it's already standing out to me because it just does a much better job of letting you explore within the rule set, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Like you do, it, it's it's not as punishing as Saga 2 is, and it also just gives you such freedom to kind of almost do whatever you want, and it's like you explore and then you stumble upon another quest. I don't know if this is how the original game was, but the remaster does a very good job of letting you just be like, okay, where was I on this quest? Like it has a good tracker for all of that information. I do wish maybe the tutorial, like, things were a little bit more explained, because I think the game does a really bad job of that early on. It is like, if you don't have that institutional knowledge of how this works, it's utterly baffling.
But then it wouldn't be if they told you those things, it wouldn't be a Kowatsu game, right? Like, there's that discovering how things work for yourself.
How did you find the e-manual? Because I was looking for that when I was playing the game, and then you sent the link in the site Slack chat. That helped. I wish I had that when I first started the game, because it does give you that little bit of background as to, like, what the hell, like. Because it does, humorously, Trials of Mana, a game that came out around the same time, does the same thing, where you start the game and it's just like, pick one of these eight characters, and you're like, well, what's this mean? Like, what do these characters do? And the game's basically just like, I don't know, just pick one of them. And with Saga 3, like, then choice kind of dictates a lot. It dictates, you know, kind of how your game starts and begins. And you could pick a character, like, if you pick Mikhail, like, you're going to start immediately in the weird war, like, the war part of the game that I have not stumbled upon in, but you, like, might not actually stumble upon it. And then there's basically an entire game mechanic locked behind playing as that one character where you basically, like, rule the kingdom. There's another thing where I was looking up, I almost wanted to restart and play as Thomas, because apparently there's a whole element of the game where you can, like, buy property, which is exactly.
He does trading for profit, basically.
Yeah, which is, I mean, it's super cool, but I wish they do have that e-manual, which, like, it's just like, if you're gonna go play this game that's not really accessible, just build it into the actual game. Don't do what Sega does with Sega Ages games, where you have to be connected to the internet to be able to see the e-manual for a game that has half of the game is in Japanese. Here's looking at you, that Sega Ages game that I reviewed the other month and can't remember the name.
Ichidant R?
Yeah. Cool idea.
Don and I just talked about that last
time. Half of it is in Japanese, and it's nothing is explained.
Yeah, I think one of the great things about Romantic Saga 3 is that I looked at that e-manual as well a little bit when I was stuck. But I found there's a couple of guides on GameFAQs that I was looking at as well. And it was really kind of using these two or three different sources and kind of taking bits of all of them and still trying to figure things out on my own that helped me kind of forge a path through. There wasn't really a definitive source that was helping me get to the next step, I suppose. There is that trial and error, I suppose. But the great thing about Saga 3 compared to Saga 2 is that Saga 3 doesn't punish you for grinding or over-leveling or being stuck or being lost. You can be lost for a long time, and that's okay. You can unlock a new area and be totally under-leveled and just leave and then come back later. Like, there's no, you're not going through a super long dungeon and feeling like it's such a big waste of time. A huge part of this is no random battles, right? This is true for Saga 2 and 3. But it also makes every dungeon feel very short and accessible, because you don't have to fight enemies if you don't want to, right? Just put on the automatic dash and you'll be out of the dungeon in a couple of minutes, you know? So that's a great part of, I think maybe a great change for Saga 3 is that everywhere you go, you're never stuck there. Whereas in Saga 2, you're kind of stuck in different generations, right? And you're also punished so heavily for grinding or for if you lose too many characters. I may have seen to David, you can get to a game over state in that game, which I think is ridiculous. You can actually run out of characters in the lineage of you're playing as a different emperor and his or her descendants throughout the game. You can get to the end and die, and then it's over. I can't imagine that happens in an RPG. To me, that blows my mind. Saga 3 doesn't have anything like that, right? It's so much more user-friendly.
Because, correct me if I'm wrong, but So when you're like going through a dungeon or an overworld or like a, you know, map fighting enemies, they like the regular enemies do match your level, correct?
Yeah, to some extent. And then I think you outpace them a little bit.
Okay, like, but weak the enemies are don't.
always weak, but
right, cuz like you can grind to defeat a boss. But then the enemies that you fight on the overworld are going to be more representative of what your level is, although it's not like there are actually traditional levels in this game either.
Yeah, that's my understanding, is that the major bosses do not level up with you. So you can grind enough to come back and be able to beat them. And you have to, because some of them are so, so bloody powerful that you know right away. And actually, that's kind of a nice thing. You know right away if you're underleveled. Like, you don't fight a boss and be like, oh, it's close. Like, you get slaughtered and you're like, okay, I'm not supposed to be here right now, or I need to grind, I need to go do some other stuff and come back later.
That's what I even ran into early on, was I basically just got to an area where I'm like, yo, I got to get out.
Like, yeah.
Like, this is not the town for me right now. I need to go to another area.
Well, the castle was like that. Like, when I went in to get the kid out of the castle, I went down one floor too many and ran into it was like a goblin king or something, and got the absolute kicked out of me. And I'm like, okay, I obviously went too far.
You're talking about the vampire castle, David?
No, so there is the one town. I can't remember the town's name, but there's, I think it's like Edwards. There's like the Edwards storyline. Like, he leads you to there's like a sick woman in a bed.
Okay.
And she's like, oh, my kid's in the Archdemon's castle. It's like the empty castle. Yeah, I guess you guys didn't do that.
I didn't even experience this. Like, that's probably really? That's probably a prologue we didn't even get to see. But that's a great thing about this game. Yeah. It's like, we all have different experiences with the first 2 hours of the game, and you're telling me about a storyline I had no idea about.
I can't believe you'd ever. So there's the
no.
So like the whole story is like every few hundred years there's like the person that's born in the eclipse or whatever that becomes either like the hero or the villain. And like the last villain's castle is kind of is available. Like, you could just walk into it, and it's abandoned by like the Archdemon, and there's all these monsters in there, and you just walk around, and there's a kid. There's a sick woman, and she's like upset that they can't find her son or something. So you volunteer to go find the son. So I went in, and there's like multiple levels to the castle. So I'm just going down and down trying to find this guy. And yeah, I went too far, and there's a goblin king, and you can actually see goblins coming out of, like, they're spawning out of this thing. So like my initial reaction was, well, I got to go kill it because there's too many goblins coming out of them. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I got absolutely plastered. So
are
then
you talking about the castle that's attached, like the poor part of town?
Yes. Yeah.
Like, there's the rich part of town, you go to the poor part of town, and then there's a castle kind of in the top left area of that town.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, that castle's a really interesting one, because it's actually connected to one of the Abyss Gates as well, I believe. So there's a couple of missions attached to it, and then you have to go back there later to get to a kind of a different dungeon as well.
Yeah, because I got down to... After I found the kid, I'm like, yeah, I want to see what's down there. So I kept going down and just avoiding enemies. And I got to a point where there was like these crystals or something and bigger enemies. And I'm like, okay, I'm really not supposed to be this far deep. So I just took off.
And you're not talking about the mission where the woman is like poisoned or she's dreaming and you go inside her dream, right?
No.
Because that's also in that town.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yep. Yeah.
There's so much to do.
That was one of the last things that I ran into.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, then... the way I ended up playing was I realized that the map was not showing all of the different places you could go. So I wanted to fill out the map so it'd be quick like that, so I could just kind of quickly run around when I need to go. So I would just go into towns and talk to everybody.
Yeah,
and
that's
they
the
would,
idea.
Yeah, and they would just tell you, oh, yeah, there's this place over there, that place over there. And I think I visited like some sand temple or something like that. And then there's some like religion that's going on at the same time where they were like, they wouldn't let me into certain buildings because I wasn't like a disciple of something.
Yeah, that's really late game stuff, I believe.
Yeah, and then I think my favorite was meeting Robin and Fat Robin.
That was such a good storyline. Like, yeah. They're like Batman type characters, yeah. And they're like catching criminals and foiling plots in this one town. But there's a skinny version and a fat one, and you only get one of them to join your team. It's hilarious. Like, yeah. But you just stumble upon it, right? You don't even know anything about it. You walk into rooms, and he, like, this Robin character flies down from the ceiling and foils an evil plot, and then he disappears. It's so bizarre.
But it's like it's so like Quasi, though, with, like, there's so many party members that you can have, and you have no idea, like, what to expect when they come on. Like, yeah. I was telling you about finding Robin, and you're like, oh, you got to put him in your party. And they're like, what do you mean, yeah, put him in my party? I didn't even know I could put him in. But then I had the max number of people, and so I think six is the maximum you can have. So I went to the bar to, like, get rid of one person, and she refused to leave, even though I was telling her she had to go.
I hate her. Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, you have to go to the city she doesn't like. And I'm like, oh my God. So I'm like trying to figure out what city she hates. And I finally figured it out. So she leaves my party, and I'm like, okay, she's gone finally. So I start walking back into town, and I could see her on the map, and she came down and followed me and went back into my party without me allowing
her. She can chase you down and join your party if you've got an empty spot. Yeah. That's brutal. And she sucks as a character, so you don't want her in your team. And I had her for a while until I realized or found out this trick for getting rid of her. But you don't want her around. Another character that's kind of like that is the bard, or I think he's called the poet in the original version. He sits in the pubs as well, and he'll join you if you talk to him. However, he also refuses to leave until you beat one of the first major bosses, and that can be hours and hours into the game. So it's just a funny thing. Like, there's no way to know that, like, exactly when he's going to leave, or that if you pick him up, you can't get rid of him for a while. But I mean, I guess that's Squatu for you, you know, that you're going to get something that is totally off the wall. Like, again, never played a game like that before.
Well, it reminded me of when Guillaume and I were talking about Legend 2, and I was saying, like, we were talking about the characters, and you're like, well, and Guillaume would say, like, certain ones are useless and the other ones are better.
Yeah, like, well, that,
you'd never know up front.
In my opinion, right? Like, the thing is, there are it's complicated, but basically, like, there's you can get humans, mutants, which are magic users, robots, and monsters. And the monsters only, you can't equip them at all. You can't change their skills. You can only eat meat left behind by enemies after a battle, you know, and it will change the nature of your monster based on some, you know, calculation that doesn't really, that no mortal, no, you know, would ever come up with. So playing it now, I've actually forced myself to put a monster in my party. And you know, you can go online, of course, people figured it out, and like there are some resources, some guides where you can type in which monster you have, and okay, and the meat from this monster, well, it will give you this result, it will give you that monster. So it's I don't know, I wouldn't recommend it. Like, I would just, like, get one robot in there, maybe a couple of humans or a couple of mutants, and then, you know, round out.
But Guy, can you drop those characters from your party if you don't want them? Like, if you don't want
monster, you'd have to.
And you've already started the game, can you get rid of them?
Yeah, not really, no. You'd have to start over. Okay. Or you have to keep eating meat until you get a monster that's less, that's more useful to you. But
right, okay, yeah. Gotcha.
So, yeah, because with Legend 2, it's you pick your character types at the start of the game,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. And then you're playing as them for the rest of the game. And what's funny is that the game is all about, like, the game starts, the story is that your dad is leaving, and he leaves through the window, you know, at night. And he's just like, goodbye, son, and then or daughter, and then goes away. And the first character, the first class that you pick is going to be the character whose dad that is. So if you pick a monster, like, you've got a human dad and a slime, or you've got a human dad and a robot. It doesn't make any sense. It's pretty great.
Yeah.
So okay, I think Legend 2 is the one that I played as a kid. Like, this is all, like, a lot of stuff that seems familiar very faintly.
It's really good.
Yeah, I really want to go back to those Legend games after playing this.
Well, that's the thing, is we were all kind of discussing at the time that Romancing Saga 3 really seems like, for someone who hasn't played a Quasi game now or doesn't realize they have, that this would be a good entry point.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I wish, like, yeah. I kind of said, I wish there was, like, a little bit more guidance, but also to what Jordan said when I made that point, was that's kind of the nature of the game, is that discovery.
I think you lose a little bit of the charm of the series or these games that Koetsu has created if you take that away, because we're so used to games that kind of are, there's so much more signposting and handholding and direction of like, okay, you need to go here, and the stories are a little bit more linear. Romantic Saga 3 is absolutely non-linear, right? Like, you can go to any town, you can start with any character, and you can recruit whoever you want, and you can ditch certain party members, you know,
or
with
try
some,
to
some with some exceptions, yeah, or try to, exactly. But they all have the different strengths and weaknesses as well. You can make them different magic users too, or you know, you can change their weapon types as well, because you get good at whatever you keep using. So there's so much flexibility about who your team ultimately is. But just this idea of that you can play the game in any order. I suppose there is maybe there are some ideal ways to play it, considering where the difficulty spikes are, right? Like, there are some quests you cannot do to start off with, because the end bosses that you encounter are just way, way too high level. So I think there is maybe a prescribed way to do it. But if you want to just grind instead, you can do any order that you want, you know?
Kawazu wouldn't want you reading a manual.
I mean, I think he'd want you to play his game.
He wants you to play his game, and he wants you to die repeatedly until you figure it out and enjoy yourself. That's my take.
I mean, judging by how his career has gone, I think that's an incorrect take.
I just wanted to see if we could talk about the life point system, because I think it's brilliant.
Oh, it's so good.
Not having to heal your party after every battle is, it's like the light bulb or the halo is going, the light is shining from above. Like, this is RPG. Like, I want this going forward. It's my new 3x speed up in RPGs, I suppose. Not having to cure myself after every battle, you know?
Because
you never run out of life points because you can get them back.
I think about, like, for example, like the RPG that took me away from Saga 3. Like, the Pokemon series has been slowly but surely refining a lot of things. Like, a lot of that early game and a lot of early RPGs are that kind of grind and hustle of, I'm gonna go explore this area, oh, everybody's hurt, I need to heal. I either heal by going back to an inn or making sure I'm equipped with potions to, you know, heal myself on the fly. And like, that's conditioned me, that's how I play games. Is like, I'm always like, all right, gonna go out in a dungeon, gotta make sure like my item bag is all stocked up, let's roll. And it is something that there's definitely an element to that works in certain games, but I love it when it's challenged. And I think that Saga 3 does a good job of challenging that, because I think that, I mean, like, you still need to make sure that people don't faint. But it's like, if someone's low on health and you're like, well, I could probably get this last guy out and then get out of the battle. Like, it changes the strategy in a way that I think makes it stand out and makes it a little more distinct and interesting and fun.
Now, I'll tell you something I learned very, very late in my playthrough. You know those, the balm item, like the potion you can use to restore health?
Yeah.
You equip on your characters? You know, yes. You can bring people back to life mid-battle with that? I didn't even know that. And I'm like,
really?
Okay, this makes the boss battle so much easier.
Because
I can actually bring characters back to life. Yeah. I thought that I'm sure that mechanic is in previous games, but I'd totally forgotten about it. And so I was like, oh, you know, I tended not to equip the bomb healing items, because I was like, oh, you know, I'll just let the characters die. They'll just come, regenerate their health after the battle anyways. But yeah, when you can bring them back during boss fights, obviously it makes some of those a lot easier. So, very important to have some type of healing on each of your characters, I would say, going into boss fights. So if you are at the right level and it's still going to be a pretty challenging fight, you can bring characters back to life, which is obviously super helpful. Yeah, I just didn't know it. I don't know. Blew my mind.
Well, we have a few other Koazu games that we'll need to get to before the end of the podcast. So maybe if Jordan and Neil have any final thoughts on Saga 3?
I guess just that I want to play more of it, but unfortunately Saga Scarlet Grace comes out next week, and I'm just very curious to play Scarlet Grace, which I imagine will have some sort of follow-up to this Koazu stuff in a couple weeks after we play that. I hope I get the chance to revisit Saga 3 because it does seem like a lost Super Nintendo classic. And Jordan, you can follow up my final thought here in that I think it might be a game that is worthy of... No, it's not better than Chrono Trigger or Final Fantasy VI, but it seems like it might be something that's worthy of being in that discussion. And I did not expect that when I heard it was coming over.
Neither did I. And I think that the visuals were the first thing that struck me. Like, oh, this looks like a game I'm probably going to really enjoy. Again, the Final Fantasy VI comparison there with the characters and stuff. A couple of thoughts I have. One is that I think if you're like me and you've always been curious about Akitoshi Kawatsu's games, this is the one to start with, I think. Like, it's super accessible. It doesn't punish you in the way that some of the other games do. And I think that it's not an easy game to play, but it's an easy game to figure out on your own or with a little bit of help. You don't need to understand all of the systems to realize that grinding actually is effective in this game. You can do it. You're not always going to know how it's going to work, but you'll eventually realize you're getting stronger abilities. Your character's HP is going up. Again, after every battle, your health gets completely replenished. You go to inns to replenish your ability powers and your MP and your life points. But again, you're never out that long in the wild before you go to an inn. So you're never going to run out of life points. A character's never going to die permanently.
Unless you get absolutely destroyed.
I mean, I don't even know how it's possible. If you said to yourself, okay, for the next 10 hours, I'm not going to go to an inn, maybe. But I never got to a state where anyone was, you know, anywhere close to the, like, one or two life points. You know, I was maybe, I think you start around 10 or 12 for each character, and I probably lost, you know, maximum 3 or 4 before I got to an inn. You know, I've never felt any pressure there. So that makes it nicer to play as well. My final thought with the game is that I hope that it sells well, and I hope the next game, Scarlet Grace, does well on Switch as well, and that we can see maybe some more remasters or just ports, simple ports of previous Saga games. I'd love to see the Legend series 1, 2, and 3 get brought to modern consoles. I think that'd be really cool. It's kind of sucky that really the only way you can go back and play them is if you have the Game Boy carts or if you want to emulate them or something. But I don't know. I think there may be mobile versions that came to Japan for those games, and maybe PlayStation or something, but I don't know that we ever got Legend 1, 2, and 3 in any other form other than the original Game Boy releases. So I'd love to see those ones come forward, and so I'm hoping this game does really well. And again, if you're on the fence about these games, I know there's a lot that maybe you've heard that doesn't sound that great. This is one that I think fixes and repairs a lot of that damage. Again, super accessible, just easy to get into. If you've got some patience for it, I think it can reward you with a pretty pretty fulfilling JRPG experience.
Perfect. Well, we're gonna take a quick break, and we'll be back with a Kawazu expert, so that we can, if you end up getting Saga 3 and you haven't got enough Kawazu yet, you get a little breakdown of where you can go from here. So stick around, and we'll be right back. And we're going to be getting into some early Kawazu, and we brought in a Kawazu fan just to make sure that we're
not saying nonsense.
Yeah, that's right.
Kawazu maniac.
Yeah. So, so joining us for a discussion is longtime Saga fan, Jonathan Finch.
It's me.
And I guess if you wanted to start with, I've been told that you're a longtime Saga fan. What game was the first one that set you down the path of Kawazu-dom?
The first one I played was the first one, but I didn't know it was Kawazu then. I didn't know it was anything. I thought it was a Final Fantasy game.
As we did all, yeah.
All of us 80 children.
It was so confusing. We're Final Fantasy Adventure, Final Fantasy Legend. Like, none of these are like the game that I played on my TV. What's going on?
I thought it was close enough.
Yeah. I think it's still an RPG.
The first Final Fantasy I played was, of course, 4/2. We're going to get confusing about this. But yeah, Final Fantasy 4. So when I jumped into Final Fantasy Legend, I didn't have any kind of experience with a regular Final Fantasy game besides the first Super NES game. So I didn't know it was different.
Jonathan, did you ever play Final Fantasy Mystic Quest?
Yes, I did.
Because I think that's like the antithesis of the Kawatsu games. You've got something that's super, super easy and almost fail-proof, and then you have something that's very, very inscrutable by comparison.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I actually started playing Final Fantasy Legend this week, and I was, it was after playing Saga 3, and I'm like, yeah, this is a Kawazu game. It was actually, it wasn't that far off of Saga, really.
Yeah.
Like, you start by choosing a character that you're given no information on whatsoever of, you know, what they do or what's good, what's bad. And then you get to choose your, after you're kind of put into the world, you get to choose your three guild members. And I thought it was pretty funny that they're expendable.
Yeah. Well, the first one is so wacky. It's like there are no set rules. They can do whatever they want. You buy your HP upgrades and your strength upgrades.
Yeah, and the humans are the only ones that actually level up.
Yeah.
And then getting thrown into castles.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you start in the first world, and it's like a standard fantasy world, but then in the second world, you're like floating around on that island, and by the end of the game, you're like an Akihabara riding a motorcycle around.
Oh my god, that sounds amazing.
So, yeah, it is amazing.
Is Final Fantasy Legend the first one? Is that the one with the big tower, and every level of the tower is like a new world?
That's right.
Okay, that's cool, yeah.
Yeah, and as you're going up the tower, there's like these little mini worlds. There might be like a town or just a house or just people wandering around. Like there's one that has damage tiles and it's like the demons are there. They're like, we're punishing these people. And the people are screaming in pain. It's really weird. Like back then, I didn't think it was that weird. But going back to it, it's like, wow, this is just bizarre stuff. But it's great.
No, I was never able to get my hands on the first one. I asked for a Final Fantasy game to my mom, and like I got Final Fantasy Legend 2, and then like subsequent Christmases, I asked for the first Final Fantasy Legend, and then I got another copy of Final Fantasy Legend 2. And I was like, what the hell is going on, Mom? That's not what I asked for. And then I can't remember which store it was, but it had the, the flaps. Like, there would be, like, these...
Toys R Us had that,
Yeah, okay, yeah. So...
I don't know if Toys R Us did too, but...
But yeah, like, you had, like, basically, like, the covers of the boxes were in envelopes that you could... And then you took kind of a ticket or the envelope or whatever, and you brought it to the counter, and they would hand you the game. And sure enough, so we went to return the extra copy of Final Fantasy Legend 2, and there was the flap for Final Fantasy Legend. And so return the game, get the new one. It's Final Fantasy Legend 2. They had like some sort of mistake in their system. And it was just like the most disappointing thing ever.
Now, a funny thing that happened there is that the Legend games were eventually republished by Sunsoft, I believe.
Oh, long after.
Ended up having different, they had different, it was, oh, that was longer after, okay, yeah.
Yeah, long
they
after.
Different box, the, they had different box covers, right?
Yeah, it didn't have a Game Boy at that point anymore.
Okay, gotcha.
I think that was 1999 when they did it.
Oh, yeah, wow, it was really late. Cause,
you know, like, you missed in the first part of the episode, I'll do very quick cliff notes. I played one of these games, don't really have a lot of specific memories of it other than playing the crap out of it in the mid 90s with no way of knowing anything about what was going on in the game.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it was 2, but I also do remember seeing it like brand new in box in the late 90s and being like, huh, like why is that here? And then years later learning the whole like Sunsoft was like, well, Game Boy's back. Pokemon, baby.
Oh yeah, I'm sure it was both Pokemon and Final Fantasy had finally made in the US, so they're like, oh, Final Fantasy Legend?
Yeah, and Square Final was Fantasy probably Adventure? Like, we are on CDs now. We are not dealing with cartridges on a Nintendo thing.
Because they had stickers on them, they're like compatible with Game Boy Color.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
I mean, they didn't add anything, but yeah, just said it was compatible just in case you didn't.
So you went back and played the first Final Fantasy Legend pretty recently, like earlier this year?
Yeah, I finished it earlier this
year. So was it worth it? Like, did it hold up? Yeah?
Yeah. I think so. I mean, you gotta go into it thinking this is a, 1989 or 1990 RPG. But I think it holds up pretty well. It's really unbalanced. Like, sometimes it's really difficult and sometimes it's super easy. And it's like, it's wild. Like, you had the mutant, or it's mutant in the US version, but it's mystic in the Japanese version. And they just kind of level up at random. Like, their HP goes up and their mana goes up, or magic, or I guess they get spells, but they learn the spells randomly.
Right.
And then you got the monster classes, which they're really hard to deal with. I don't recommend them unless you're doing it just for fun.
Right.
Well, and they have the life system. It's not really like the one in Saga 3. This one has, like, it's basically a 3 strikes and you're out. So if you have to revive the character 3 times, they're just gone, and you have to go get a fresh guild member.
Yep.
Is there a way to replenish the life points if you've lost them?
I think you can buy it.
Yeah, but it's extremely expensive.
Okay, so it's maybe not worth it. Better to get someone else.
Yeah, like, I was looking at it. I think it's, like, most of this items are like $100 or $200, and I think buying a life was $10,000.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's right.
Do you get gold, or do you get money from battles? Because that's something that really doesn't happen in Romantic Saga 3. You basically get no money from the battles, and the main way you get resources is just from treasures or completing quests or something like that.
You do.
Okay, yeah. Okay. So more standard.
It's pretty minimal. It's like, I think, like 40, or at least early on, it was like 40 gil, I think, for every... I was fighting like goblins and zombies and stuff and getting like 40, 50 gil.
So even then, it wouldn't be feasible to try to save up money to buy life points. You might as well just re-roll.
No, because I had to pretty much like drop all the... I had to... As soon as I was getting money, I was having to buy items. Because the thing is... The only way to attack is with the weapons, and then the weapons have only so many attacks. So you're always like having to buy new equipment, and then I can't remember if it was the mutants or the humans. You had to buy it's like called the plus 200 HP item, where
that's the humans.
Yeah, so the humans have to equip HP so that they're not like at 40.
So they don't gain health naturally through combat.
No.
No.
Oh, really? Wow, okay.
Yeah, you got to buy these items and use them on it. And by the end of the game, I think there's like an HP 600. I think that's as high as it goes.
Yeah.
So it's actually better to go back and start just buying a bunch of HP 200s, because even after... Okay, so the HP 200, it tops out at 200, and after you get to 200, you only get like 1 hit point every time you use it. Mm-hmm. It just goes up, and the thing is, they're so expensive by the end, it's better just to keep buying the HP 200s and just keep using them.
Are those items, or is it equipment that you put on? Is it an item you use?
Yeah, it's an item you use.
Okay. And there's only so many items you can hold or equip.
Right.
Yeah.
And that also depends on, and like each of the characters has different sexes too, which changes it. And then it has your monsters that eat the food, that changes, and
eat the meat.
Eat the meat. Yeah, I heard.
That's the name of that tune that plays at the end. It's called "Eat the Meat."
That's a good banger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now I thought the music in Final Fantasy Legend 2 was better than Final Fantasy 1, and I'm not sure if Uematsu was involved in the first one or not.
I think he was involved in the first one. I'm not 100% sure off the top of
my head. I think it's mostly the Game Boy. Yeah, I think it's mostly Kenji Ito doing soundtracks.
I think Ito stepped in on the second one.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, because
that's what I remembered. I had to look it up.
Uematsu is credited solely on the Final Fantasy Legend.
Right.
As it was called in North America. And then Legend 2, Ito. Joins in.
Yeah, they both have fantastic soundtracks. Yeah.
So what Kawazu game would you consider your favorite?
I think Romancing Saga, the first one.
Really? So did you play that as a ROM, like with a translation patch, or is it the PlayStation 2 remake, or?
Oh no, I'm sorry, Saga Frontier.
Oh, okay, sorry. Yes.
So many. Yeah, I was gonna say, like, I haven't heard a lot of good things about the original game.
No, the original's not great. The original's okay. It's neat for what it is, but no, Saga Frontier 1, that's what I meant to say. That's my favorite.
And that was a PlayStation game, right?
Yeah, it's a PS1 game.
How are the Frontier games different from the Romancing series or the Final Fantasy Legend games?
I think that, well, okay. So each one is kind of different. Mm-hmm. Like, each series, like the Romancing Saga are really open-ended, but from what I've played, I haven't played every Romancing Saga, but there's not a lot of, there's not a lot of direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's really not like a lot of dialogue either. Like they'll walk up to them, they maybe say two lines of dialogue and then they're on their way.
Yeah, the NPCs are very brief in their conversations with you.
Yeah. Like the first Romancing Saga, like a lot of from what I've played, a lot of it's just like quest you go on. Like you'll go into a shop and they say, there's someone killing shopkeepers, go ask the shopkeeper about it. And then you go into the dungeon and then you go fight a boss and then you go back and like, oh, you did it. And there's not really a whole lot of dialogue otherwise.
Hmm.
But I think Saga Frontier is a lot more focused. Like, it is very obvious when you play it that it's an unfinished game. But they really tried to make it story-based with that one. Like, it has, I think there's 7 characters.
Yeah.
And each one of them has at least an interesting story beginning. Even if there's not, like, a lot between the beginning and end.
Is the battle system the same as the rest? Like, where it's more about the equipment than the actual leveling up?
Yeah, it's... Saga Frontier 1 is kind of like the... I would say it's like the result of the previous games. Like, every game kind of feeds into itself, if that makes sense.
I get what you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, Saga Frontier 1, like, you get a lot of the sparks. Like, the sparks where you learn new moves. Mm-hmm. That's really important to the game. So it's, I guess the weapons are important, but I think the spark moves are more important.
But the spark moves depend on the weapons that you've been using.
Right, right.
I feel like in Romancing Saga 3, getting new equipment actually can make a big difference. So you want to get to the end of the dungeons. Even if you don't find the final boss, if you can scour the dungeons and find the treasures and get new swords and new armor, new bows, whatever it is, if your weapons get stronger, you get significantly powered up. So, of course, you want to spark new abilities. That's huge, too. But having good weapons is almost as important, I would say.
Frontier 1 almost sounds like Alliance Alive.
So, it like, I definitely get that vibe as well. And we were pointing out when looking at Saga 2 and Saga 3 that they kind of were made in parallel with Secret of Mana and Trials of Mana. Like, both of those games are, you know... Mana 2 and Saga 2 came out months apart from each other in Japan, and then Saga 3 and Mana 3 all came out within months apart from each other. But then there wasn't another Mana game until that terrible one on PlayStation in the late 90s.
No, it's fantastic.
I also don't really like Secret of Mana, so maybe my Mana takes are just bad. But Koichi Ishii, who's the Mana guy, also now at Grezzo, was the director of Ever Oasis. But Koichi Ishii worked alongside Kawatsu on Saga Frontier, which is just interesting. Like, I'm kind of stumbling upon this whole, like, underneath Square making Final Fantasy games and setting the world aflame in the late 90s. You have the Saga series and the Mana series kind of going on almost in tandem and in parallel. And yeah. Saga Frontier, from what you were describing and what I'm also from just glancing at the Wikipedia page for it, it's a game that I've never played and honestly don't know much about because I've only Romancing Saga 3 has made me really kind of appreciate and like this series more than I really ever have. But it is like it seems like they have elements of what kind of made the Mana series really good on Super Nintendo, kind of like eking their way into the Saga framework.
Hmm. Well, Legend of Mana is also a Kawazu produced game.
Yeah,
and you can kind of say a lot of that in there. Like, there's a lot of stuff that's not explained, and I think it shares a lot of the staff with Saga Frontier as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like
in the Romantic Saga.
It seems like basically post Super Nintendo, I would assume that the Mana and the Saga teams kind of joined together. Especially with how and like Kawatsu and Ishii were the leaders of both of those teams, I'm pretty sure.
Is there a Saga game that you didn't like that you would warn people to stay away from?
so there's like one that is like heavily board game inspired. Like, what's up with that?
Unlimited Saga?
Yeah, like, I just...
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it is a, it is heavily board game inspired, but I still think it's a great game.
No, I mean, like, that's something that appeals to me. Like, I love me some Fortune Street. So it's give me some weird board game RPG stuff. Also, that game, like, Billion Road, that's coming over on Switch in 2020, that game looks cool. Should talk about it on the Mage. But
I need to look about it. I need to look that up. Billion Road.
Yeah, it's just apparently like it's a pretty big game in Japan that's getting a localization from like one of those like non-Xseed localization houses that every now and then you come up and be like, oh, is that like Monster Mod piece? No, okay, maybe I'll pay attention.
It's not Idea Factory.
I think it, but it's like it's something like that.
No Moe Chronicles. Moeru Chronicles, whatever they called it for the Switch.
Oh, they're basically just we'll trick the people into not realizing it's the creepy Vita game.
Yeah, I have to look that up. Is that like Nipponichi? Probably.
No, smaller. I have to look it up. Smaller. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Smaller Nipponichi. All right.
And did you Scarlet Grace? I think is the latest, like the last Kawazu, right?
Yeah, I have not played Scarlet Grace. I barely know anything about Scarlet Grace.
Yeah, because it only...
I want to experience it new.
It came out in Japan on the Vita.
Like, yeah, it was going to come out so much earlier, but then they ran into problems with the English port on the Vita, I think. And I don't know if they actually ran into technical problems or if the problem was no one has a Vita. But then they...
I would assume it's no one has
Saga
a Vita.
Saga 3 came out on Vita.
Yeah, right. Yeah, now...
that's right, Romantic Saga 3.
Yeah, but then like yeah, they were like they delayed it and eventually they announced it for PC and Switch, and also it's coming out on Vita still, so that's good.
It's exciting. Yeah. It's only a week or two away, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like December 3rd. Yeah.
It is next Monday.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Should I talk about Final Fantasy Legend 2, which I've been playing recently?
Yeah,
for this podcast. So it's the game that I grew up with, and in a way I was lucky because it's basically my first Kawazu for babies, because unlike the Final Fantasy Legend or any other Kawazu game that you can name, Final Fantasy Legend 2 is very kind of... I would describe some of Kawazu's games as mean. And
I can see
that. And Saga 2 or Final Fantasy Legend 2 is not that. Like it's very like it's got training wheels upon training wheels, you know. If your party gets wiped out, you get revived. You know, at the beginning of the battle where you were wiped out. Often I think you've got, like, if you choose run instead of fight, you've got a very good chance usually of running away, except when it's bosses, I think.
Yeah, it's pretty high. It's almost assured that you're going to run away. Every once in a while, you
will. Yeah. And the game is extremely linear. So the story and the structure, well, I'm not going to talk exactly about the story, but basically like the world that it's set in, you've got a multiple worlds. And instead this time of a tower that you're climbing, you've got these pillars of sky that bring you from one world to the next. And so you start in the first world, you get to the next one, you kill a new god, someone who's using the power of Magi to kind of become a god. And you get the Magi from him or her, and then that allows you to unlock the next world. And so you just keep accumulating these Magi things and keep exploring these new worlds. And usually they're pretty small and they might contain, you know, a dungeon or two, a town or two. And one weird thing that I noticed this time that I'm playing it for the first time in like 25 years or something, it kind of reminds me of Dragon Quest, in that each world has its own little drama going on that you kind of solve before moving on to the next one.
I was just thinking about that when you were talking about it. So, yeah, they have these little stories in each world.
Yeah, and so I'm going to... This is one of the better stories, and I'm just going to spoil it because, as we mentioned, unfortunately, there's no easy way to play Final Fantasy Legend 2 in 2019. There's no... collection like a Secret of Mana or anything, but in the world where you fight Venus, so there's like this big walled city protected from the monsters outside, and everyone who is good looking can stay in the city.
Yeah.
And so there's this little drama going on. There's like this Flora woman who is set to marry Nils, some sort of monster, but apparently who's pretty. I don't really get it. But she loves Leon, who unfortunately injured his leg, and as such is not perfect enough to live in the city anymore. He was cast out. So you go explore outside the walls of the city, you meet Leon, and then some volcano pops up for no reason. So you explore the volcano, you get some magi, and as you explore the volcano, you see the sprite of Leon sometimes. Like, well, sometimes like the game seems to chug or something. Like you're exploring, and then like, oh, how come I'm not moving forward anymore? And if you notice, like at the other end of the screen, you see the sprite of Leon just kind of like popping in and then disappearing. So you clearly, like, he's just following you into this volcano. And then you reach the exit, you get the final piece of Magi, and then he's like, oh, I'm sorry, I have to do this. And then, like, he pushes you down and steals your Magi. And so you go see Venus, who's officiating the wedding between Flora and Nils. And Leon's just like, oh, you know, like, you witch, I'm going to kill you with this Magi. And she's like, well, what are you going to do with a little knife and a piece of Magi? Can't do anything against me. I'm a god. And so she pushes him away. And Flora is just like, look, I love Leon. I want to stay with him. Please make an exception. And of course, Venus is a bitch. And she's like, how do you presume to tell me what to do? And so Flora's like, look, and she takes Leon's knife and slashes her face, and she's like, no, I'm ugly, so cast me out. And Venus is not gonna have it, and so you have to, then you're like, okay, we have to kill you, we have no choice. So like, I was kind of surprised, because when I played this game originally, I barely understood English. There's way more going on in this game in terms of story than I would have expected. And it's just like, I remembered chucking grenades at Venus, and but that was about it. And yeah, like, I'm really enjoying it this time. And as I said, like, it's extremely linear. You solve a dungeon, you solve a little problem, and then you move on to the next world. And it's been kind of difficult, but I think it's because when I was a kid, I would just grind for money forever to buy the best equipment before moving on. I haven't been doing that, so I could make it easier.
You had free time too?
Yeah, I did, yeah. But but without grinding, I made it all the way to the Nasty Dungeon, which it's actually called Nasty Dungeon. It's one of the final few worlds in the game. And yeah, at this point, maybe I'll have to grind a little bit, because it really deserves its name. But it's been like kind of breezy, you know? Like I went through it, like, I must have been playing for less than 10 hours, and I'm almost at the end already. So it's really enjoyable, and I wish that there was some easy way for people to play it today. But what you have to do is, grab some Game Boy compatible Game Boy and find the original Game Boy cartridge, I guess, or pirate the whole thing. But eh.
I still have the Sunsoft one that I bought in 1999, probably.
Nice. Yeah, no, Karen had bought me a copy a few years ago, I think probably at one of the PAX East that I went to, and I hadn't really mustered the courage to play it until now, but it really holds up. I'm surprised. Like, usually when I go back to a game that I liked as a kid, it's just like, okay, this didn't age well, but this holds up.
No, this one has. For a Game Boy Japanese RPG, it's way better than you'd expect.
And this was like, this came out, okay, let me, I had the page not that long ago. Okay, so this came out in Japan in December, almost 1991, December 1990, and came out a year later.
Like a relatively early Game Boy game.
Right, like, yeah.
It's kind of crazy how well it holds up for being like a second year of Game Boy game.
Yeah, so this would have come out like the same year as Final Fantasy III, the NES one, or Super not Super, the Famicom one. So yeah, so it's kind of like the The storytelling is more advanced than I would have thought. Like they do some surprising stuff. Like the Leon thing that who's like stalking you through the dungeon. Like that's not something that you associate with. Well, it's pretty advanced for a freaking Game Boy game.
Are you gonna leave us with the banana tease or?
Oh God, yeah. So the banana thing. So no, there's no secret like Koatsu or Sagaguchi like obsession for bananas. This was because the Nintendo of America was very strict about what you could show or not show or not tell in their the games that would be available on their platforms, right? So stuff like yeah. Crosses and Castlevania were edited out and things like that. And originally, the world where it's kind of like Edo era Japan. I'm not sure how to say this. Anyway, like with like shoguns and stuff. So that world, there are, drug smugglers, of course, like probably like smuggling opium, but, in the original version in Japanese, but in the translation, bananas for some reason, there's literally an NPC in the game who's just like, oh, for some reason, bananas are not allowed in this world. And the some reason to me tells me that someone like the translator was just like, yep, I'm not going to try to explain it. It's not my problem. You know?
That banana will get you real loopy.
Yeah. He's talking about how much he wants bananas. And he said, yeah, they're not, I can't get them here for some reason.
That's weird. Yep. And that's pretty silly. And I swear, like the localization or the translation is already kind of iffy because it's kind of low quality. Like there's a lot of mistakes and stuff. But I swear, in that world, it seems worse than the worlds previous. It barely makes sense at some point, the dialogue. And I think it's just like the translator was just like, you know what, I don't have to deal with this.
That's pretty standard for like 1990 or 1991.
Yeah,
especially on Game Boy.
Like, yeah,
we didn't get like good localization until like the late 90s for the most.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I think it would have been funnier if that had changed your whole perception on bananas as a kid.
Well, I didn't really question it, right? Like, and I barely understood what was going on in the game in general. Yeah. So
that's how it was. Yeah. It's like, yeah, all these misspellings and bad grammar. We don't care.
Yeah.
That's just how it is.
But I was kind of surprised. Like, I must have picked up more than I thought I did. Because, so I made it to Venus in the game in 2019. And I'm like, okay, the grenades suck. Why do I remember chucking grenades at Venus so much? Like, why is that imprinted in my memory? And then I actually fight Venus and all my weapons miss. And all the magic, like, she's impervious to all the magic. And the grenades never miss. So I actually had I had found the right strategy against her. And I was like, oh yeah, okay, maybe I should give myself more credit. Like as a kid, I actually figured out a few things about this game. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know where that anecdote is going. So take it away.
It means to, I guess you should just listen to your inner youth. That's the
I guess so, for. Yeah.
Yeah. It kind of takes me into the what I was thinking of for the topic for last call, and
I have more Koatsu. I feel like in the Koatsu, we're missing out the weird tide in Nintendo history he has, because especially his games past Saga 3 have almost predominantly all been on Sony platforms.
Right.
But there's that whole thing with the game designer studio. So there was that period of time where Square was exclusive to Sony. And they started a shell company so that way they could work with Nintendo. And the way that worked was they made the game designer studio. And then Square held 49% of the shares. And Koatsu, who was the head of a development division at Square, held 51%. So they made this studio. And then they started working with Nintendo on Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles. That was the only game that the game designer studio ever made. It was founded in 1999. It was eventually shut down in 2010. But then it also played a role into Square. Well, and then Square became Square Enix. And then Square Enix got to a point where it was acquiring Taito, makers of Bubble Bobble and Arkanoid and stuff like that.
Space Invaders.
Yeah, Space Invaders as well. And when they were, you know, merging with Taito, I guess for some, for whatever arcane business reasons that I don't totally understand, the game designer studio, which at this point was called Squex, S-Q-E-X Corporation, that company then merged with Taito and then took on the name Taito Corporation, and then eventually in 2010 was dissolved into Square Enix.
Weird.
And somehow, like, Ubisoft is also loosely tied to this entire escapade as well. But like, that's something as thumbing around Komatsu's history, I was like, oh yeah, he worked on Crystal Chronicles. And then looking at who's credited as the developer for Crystal Chronicles, it is the game designer studio. And hey, we're gonna get to play Crystal Chronicles in like 2 or 3 months on Switch, which hopefully that port's good, because that would be a game that would be very fun to play now, I think. Maybe. Yeah.
I guess they needed those shell companies for the banana smuggling.
Yeah. That's all Komatsu's just like, I gotta get the bananas into America.
Yeah, there's like, that whole banana, there's like this police drama going on in the background too. Yes. Like that girl's father is like the detective trying to track down the banana smugglers, but I think he gets killed.
Yeah, like she took over after him because she's such a tomboy, and yeah, like he got killed over bananas. And it's funny because you meet the shogun, who the two NPCs describe as being like soft in the head, and yeah, like he and like crooked like wares seller, whatever, like a shop owner who has suspiciously good equipment to sell. Like, they're just, like, yucking it up, like, oh, you're so evil, selling bananas, and like, yes, but you're not as bad as you. It's this whole thing.
The dialogue was so funny.
It is. Like, it's played for laughs, right? Like, because they're, like, basically kneeling on a cushion, like, in front of a small table. Like, I don't know, like, their sprites are going back and forth, and they're just like, yuck, 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 yuck.
Yeah, the game is actually really funny, too. It's like, I don't know if they intended it as funny as it is, but, like, when you fight Apollo, they're like, oh, no, we can't kill you because then we can't get revived again. He's like, hi, you think you can kill me?
Right, yeah, Odin, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's what I mean. Sorry.
Right.
Well, we were talking about on the 8-Bit episode how it seems like there was that humor that was happening during that early, I guess it would be kind of the early to mid-90s, that just never, it kind of just stayed in that time period. It hasn't really come back.
Right, and in terms of, like, in terms of Square Final Fantasy games, you mean?
Yeah, like that goofiness, you know?
That's actually, yeah. As much as I'm not the biggest fan of 15, I mean, I also just don't kind of like the overall direction of Final Fantasy. Is like, it's not a turn-based franchise anymore, and I don't really jive with that as much. But 15 seemed to at least like take it a little less seriously, which I appreciated. Like, I mean, like 13, I guess you did have, like, the dude had an afro and had a chocobo in his hair. I guess that's weird. But
Zaz.
Like it seems like there are still some efforts to not take things as seriously, but for the most part, there is a goofiness that does seem to have been lost and left behind in the, you know, Game Boy Super Nintendo era.
Yeah.
13 was pretty wacky, though.
Yeah, I actually... I remember like maybe enjoying
Final Fantasy. It was off the wall wacky.
Yeah, yeah.
Like two girls that turned into a motorcycle.
Yeah. I remember that.
Final boss is like this weird face in a wall.
Port 13 to Switch. I'd probably play that again.
Oh god, man, I want that so much.
Okay, when are we doing the Thirsty Mage on Final Fantasy 13?
No, but we have to do it on all three games. Let's see.
I want all three of them on Switch. Yeah. I want them yesterday.
I actually did start 13 like 2 months ago and didn't get very far, but I was thinking about it.
Nice.
The graphics were actually surprisingly, like, they were a lot better than I remember.
Oh, well, the first 13 has better graphics than 2 and 3.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they just, like, built it that way, right? And also they spent so much time just, like, making rocks or whatever. Like, the there are stories about how, like, they were creating assets, and they kept creating assets because they had, like, the artists had nothing to do while the development was stalling, right? Anyway.
Yeah. It's too bad, like, every Final Fantasy since 12 has been so troubled.
Yeah.
This is the last call for alcohol this evening. Drink up, drink up, drink up, and order again. This is the last call for alcohol.
This is actually a good segue into what I was thinking for last call, which is the linear versus open world aspect of, like, what's your preference? Because it sounds like with, like, Guy, you like the Final Fantasy Legend 2, which is more directional, like, linear in the story. And Jonathan, you're saying, like, Saga Frontier was kind of that way, too. It leaned more towards a story-based, yeah. I guess, eh?
You get a lot of both in Saga Frontier, too. It's a good mix of both.
Yeah, what is your guys' preference of? Do you appreciate the linear more, or do you kind of like that open, do what you want when you want sort of gameplay?
For RPGs, I find the openness kind of bizarre and sometimes misleading. You know, like, yeah, sure, you can explore anywhere you like, but over here there are like level 50 monsters, and over there level 80. So really, you've only got the one path, right? So yeah. I kind of like the when it doesn't pretend that it's not linear. but it turns out, you know, as you guys explained, as you described the game, Romancing Saga 3 seems like it's much less. It's not that. It's much less linear than what I'm describing. So I don't know. Maybe I haven't really played a good non-linear RPG, but in my experience, the kind of the openness of the world is more of a pretense. Like it's more of a, okay, like we give you like this big area, but there's only one place that you're supposed to go. And it's more a matter of, you have to find it. You have to find out where to go. It's not like you can go anywhere.
Yeah, it's a more theoretical, I guess you'd say. It's like in theory, it's supposed to be open, but it's not really.
Yeah, you have to get to B, but B is hidden. You have to find it, right? Whereas like an actual non-linear RPG would be like, you can go to B, you can go to C, you can go to D directly from A. It doesn't matter, right?
Yeah, I don't know if any of the sagas are like truly non-linear, because you're going to go to some areas and there's going to be the monsters that are just way too strong for you, so you have to go to another one first and come back later. Like that happens a lot, especially in Saga Frontier.
I mean, I feel like Guy, you were almost digging at the Xenoblade series with the idea of like,
yeah, a little bit,
yeah, which I feel like the Xenoblade series is one that I can use as an example of what I kind of prefer, is that you have your moments, you do have that capacity to like, okay, I'm just going to kind of explore, like do some side quests, kind of like look around this town, look around the area around this town, and then there is a guided path to take me through the story. But I have these moments where I can kind of explore and screw around. And I like that from both, just like I enjoy exploring worlds and games. And it does kind of give it that. So I know like Jordan, for example, his MO lately has been beating RPGs very quickly, because especially with those Final Fantasy ports, when they like take away random battles, he would just ignore those and go from point A to point B very quickly. But I like having the ability to do that if I really wanted to and not have to deal with as much fluff. But then if I do want to deal with the fluff, it's there and I can explore a world. So I guess like a linear focused storyline with open world destinations might be my
preference. Neil, I'm gonna quickly hop in here, guys, just because I got to leave. I think what we didn't really see in JRPGs, at least ones that came west, was a lot of open-ended make your own path or make your own way forward types of games, right? And so you had the JRPGs, which were more linear, and the Western RPGs, which were more open. And I guess where I come down to that is I like both. But what I'd really like to see is maybe a game like Romancing Saga 3 that tries to do a little bit of both, or is more open-ended than you might see in traditional Japanese role-playing games. So I do like seeing new things like that I'm not all that used to, but I think I do slant towards the more linear-focused storylines naturally, just because maybe it's experience, it's growing up with those games, I don't know, but I think that's kind of where I come down on that. Like I like my Western RPGs a little bit more open-ended, I like my Japanese RPGs a little bit more linear, and so I can kind of pick and choose which type of game I'm feeling at the moment. But I'm gonna hop off here, I gotta go put out some fires, so good talking to you guys, and I'll talk to you soon.
Have a good one.
Bye.
Yeah, I mean, what Jordan was saying to that end, like I think I just ultimately like flexibility. Like don't ram me down either path. Allow me to kind of make my own decision in the game.
Yeah, like Final Fantasy 15 kind of hits that a little bit, because like there's obviously a story and it's linear, and there's like point A, point B, point C, but there's a lot of stuff in between that if you just want to screw around, there's stuff to do.
Sure.
Yeah,
and I know it doesn't. It's almost too bad that they went action RPG on it, because, like you were saying, Neil, like there is some of that goofy humor in it, like when they go camping and stuff. Like that's the conversations that they have is fun, and then when they're like chirping each other in the car rides, like to me, the really only bad part about it was the move over to that action RPG style. I wish they had stayed with the turn based, because I think a lot of what happened in that game is right up my alley. It was just that the combat system is my only real nitpick with that game.
I think the combat was the weakest part.
Yeah,
because they were talking about like playing King's Knight. You remember that?
Yeah,
the old Square RPG game. But what's his name? Was it Noctis? No, not Noctis was the main. Whoever the youngest character was.
Oh, Prompto.
Yeah, Prompto.
Yeah, Prompto.
Yeah.
Kept talking about how great King's Knight was.
I mean,
that was kind of like the opposite of Final Fantasy 13.
I mean, Final Fantasy 6 is always a game that's a good example of kind of blending both worlds to me, because you have the first half of the game is very structured, like rigidly so. And then the second half, like you can go march and fight Kefka kind of like right when you begin the second half, like you'll get destroyed, but you can do it. And you kind of you get your party back together kind of in almost whatever order and whatever way you see fit. And that,
yeah, if you want to go in there with three people, go
ahead.
The other game that's like that, of course, is Final Fantasy VII, which I haven't really played past the opening area, which why is that escaping me now? The town
Midgar,
yeah. So I make it out of Midgar, but it's not the openness of the overworld that stopped me. It was the fact that it seemed like every place that I went to forced me to play some minigame that I wasn't enjoying. So
there's like, so many minigames in Final Fantasy VII. It's absurd.
Oh my God.
It did not stand out that bad to me when I played it when I was younger, but replaying it on Switch, like I still like the game a lot.
Yeah. Oh my God. So I stopped after Midgar most of the time, but I do enjoy the linearity of that section, because it kind of the story beats keep happening, right? Like they just like there's a good pace to it, and then you're thrown into the overworld, and I think I would probably enjoy the overworld as well, but your progression is kind of dependent on whether you want to play like, I don't know, it's not tower defense or something, but there's like people climbing a cliff or
it's like a real-time strategy game.
Oh my God.
Yeah, well, and what's funny is that it doesn't even matter, because you actually get better items if you just let them come up the tower and then fight them.
Oh,
so okay. The mini game itself is like, I wouldn't even bother playing it. Like,
because but then there's like a mini game.
Fort Condor sucks.
Yeah, because if you win the mini game, you don't get there's like, I don't remember what the item is, but I just remember it was a very useful piece of equipment that you can win, that you get when you actually fight them. But if you actually win the mini game, then you don't get to fight them and you don't get the equipment.
Oh God.
See, I think all the mini games in Final Fantasy VII are terrible, but all together they make the game more interesting.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I don't know, the hot or cold minigame in the other town that you can go to where there's some sort of archaeological dig is, I don't think that makes anything interesting.
I think it does. I disagree.
I mean, I also think about how some of that weirdness leads to great moments in Final Fantasy VII, like the entire Yuffie segment, which I think is just, it's awesome. Like, I love that. Yeah. Even if I always hate stumbling upon it, but the outcome. Yeah, it's like
everyone's like on vacation going to Yuffie Town.
Yeah. Is Sephiroth going to ruin the world? I don't know, man. We're just hanging out here.
Are you telling me, Guillaume, that you did not enjoy the squat off with the right slash box?
I'm not sure if I got there. I'm sorry to have derailed this the last call topic, but
I mean, it's the end of the episode. It's
Final Fantasy XII was. I mean, it gave you the path, but it was also really open ended. Like you could go. There are big areas that you did not have to go to.
Man, I would probably love Final Fantasy XII. I need to play that damn game.
Kawazu had to step in the end to save it because what was his name? Matsuno.
Matsuno.
Yeah, he kind of had a nervous breakdown.
That was a 10 out of 10 on NWR. I don't know what to tell you.
I'll give it
a 10 out of 10.
Who reviewed it?
11 out of 10.
Somebody who really likes Square games. That's all I know.
Yeah. 12. Yeah. No, I bought Final Fantasy 12. It's just that there are 14 million games on Switch. So.
Right.
Oh yeah.
I got Final Fantasy 12 on the PlayStation 2 originally, and I stopped playing when it kind of opened up. But and that's funny because the linear part at the beginning is super boring because it's just like you just go through sewers for hours. I remember like thinking like, you know what? I think I'm done with RPGs forever just because they always start you off in some sewers. And it's like, why do you do this, developers? It's not interesting.
Did you at least get to the point where Vaughn walks around town announcing to the world that he's Rosh von Vossenberg?
I don't remember, but maybe not.
I mean, that deserves like 1 point right just for that one sequence alone. That was stellar.
Yeah, but I guess like Final Fantasy XII is the counterpoint to this idea that a linear RPG has like kind of a good pacing and like story beat after story beat. I just remember the beginning of that game really being slow. And so there's a way to do linear badly.
Yeah.
And
that game does pick up. So if you end up getting back to it one day, I think you
one day. Yeah. One day.
One day.
Yeah.
The backlog.
I don't think it's bad.
I clearly thought it was great.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I've heard good things. I didn't stick with it.
I love Final Fantasy XII. That's one of my favorite games of all time.
Yeah. Well, it wouldn't be a Mage episode if it didn't devolve into Final Fantasy talk. But if did you guys have any final thoughts or things to say on Kwazu or the
Saga series? If we can, like, stop time. And I can play all these damn RPGs. That'd be real cool.
Yeah. I just want to briefly mention that I thought that I would be able to play Final Fantasy Legend 2 and Romancing Saga, the remake on PlayStation 2 for this podcast, which shows you how delusional I am. but quickly, I stopped the Romancing Saga remake because... I didn't even get through like the prologue with the character that I picked, a pirate named Hawk, and the game was not as easy as Final Fantasy Legend 2, and probably not as good, and probably like the move to a 3D remake was not in its favor because I don't know, like it's got like the stationary camera that just and your character, your 3D the anyway, like your character moves really slowly. It hasn't aged well. Like I feel like maybe if they had done like a 2D remake, it could have been better. These are my very unformed opinions on a Romancing Saga remake. But I wouldn't. I certainly wouldn't advise hunting down a copy for years and years, like I did, because you're going to be disappointed. Yeah.
See, I think it's a really good remake.
Well,
I'm going to disagree, but it's also been, 15 years since I last played it?
Yeah, I just got less patience also nowadays.
It's kind of crazy how much of a ground-up remake it was. Like, it had to have a significant budget, and it has voice acting.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it has like its charm, I guess. But the character, I think the character models, I think were people. What's the word? It's really late at this point. But yeah, like a lot of people hated them.
A lot of people did hate them. I thought they were kind of.
They look like
I can see
they're very chibi and weird in my opinion. But the also like the this remake also took elements from Romancing Saga 2 and 3 and brought them over to the first one, I think. So like this whole thing that Jordan was raving about the bomb being able to revive your characters mid battle and stuff like that, that's in this game. There are like the flash, the what are they called, the light bulbs,
sparks,
the yeah. sparks.
It's probably a different word for them. I just call it sparks.
Yeah, so they're in that game and. Yeah, anyway, so it seems to be like a much improved remake, but I just it's also very kind of opaque, doesn't explain its systems, and it does that thing where I read in the in FAQ anyway that if you keep getting into battles, you're going to miss events. Every battle that you fight kind of like means that some events pop up in the world and some others disappear. And eventually, if you get into enough battles, like I think that the enemies become all of a sudden really a lot tougher.
There's like a boss, I think it's called the Jewel Leader or something.
Right.
He's going around like destroying the continent.
I think there are several of them. Like I was looking in the FAQ and it just seemed to be like, oh, Jewel Eater comes out or something. It's just like, holy crap. Like you don't even know when you're playing the game that each time that you're fighting a battle, you're just bringing like doom upon yourself.
Yeah, you really are. That's the truth.
So that's what I meant like earlier when I said that Kowazu's games can be mean. Like this seems mean to me.
It's kind of funny. It's really funny thinking about it that way. It's like, yeah, he's not telling you what's going to happen, but you know what? You're going to pay for this in the end.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of the reason why I like Saga 3 so much, because it seems like one of the least mean games of his that I've ever played.
Well, that's good. Maybe I'll start with that one and then work my way back.
You could probably chart Kowazu's moods year by year based on the games he's made.
Like, yeah, he went through the divorce. That's what led to that happening.
There are the remakes on DS of Saga 2 and 3. And I haven't played all of it, but the Saga 2 remake is really good.
I wanted to play it back in the day, but then it never came out here. So got to find a patch room and stuff. And yeah.
It's so weird that we actually got the games we got, though. It's like, who said it was okay for Unlimited Saga to come out here?
There was still, I mean, that's we're reaping the benefits of the era after Final Fantasy VII, where there was just that RPG gold rush. Like, it's crazy how many games that were just I mean, the Saga series was ostensibly Japan only, outside of the weird Final Fantasy Game Boy games. And then Saga Frontier came to North America because, oh, Final Fantasy VII sold a bajillion copies. Like, let's roll with everything.
I was the one filling out those mail-in cards with, like, Final Fantasy VI saying I wanted Romantic Saga. Because they had them in, like, EGM, and I guess Game Fan had them, too. It was like, wow, these games look cool. I wish they came out here.
Well, hopefully with the Switch, that'll continue where maybe Square of just like, eh, well, we found the code, let's throw it on the Switch.
It's so weird to me that they got the push they did the Switch remakes, at least three in Saga Scarlet Grays.
Yeah.
Because they were like, hey, look at these games. These are great. These are classics. You love them. But there's such like mean games that you don't understand when you get into them. They don't tell you anything about the systems or anything within the game. You just have to figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's crazy that now on Switch and I think it's every modern console at this point. You can play Saga 2 and 3, and then you'll be able to play Scarlet Grace in like in a matter of days.
All right. Well, this is probably a good spot to wrap it up. If Jonathan, do you want to let people know where they can find you if they'd like to follow you on Twitter?
Finchikins on Twitter. FinchieKins. You can read my post yelling about Unlimited Saga being the best, most understood game ever.
And Guillaume, if someone wants to see that nice pick that you put in today of bananas,
oh yeah, sure,
the secret banana smuggling.
Yeah, so my Twitter is what is it? Guillaume NWR. Somewhere in this podcast description, I'm sure you can find out how to spell my name. And yeah, and also I'm on Radio Free Nintendo, where I don't talk about RPGs that much, but I do love RPGs. And, of course, yeah, we talk about lots of different Nintendo games, and what else can I say? We talk about Nintendo. We love Nintendo, so that makes us special. No one else loves Nintendo. like we do.
As a Guillaume talks Nintendo on RFN, and he comes over here to talk about Square.
Yep.
And Neil?
First off, I will say that who you heard like a half an hour ago was Jordan Rudek. You can find him on Twitter at riskman64. You can find me on Twitter at NRON10 and Ron10. And yeah, I'm really excited for Scarlet Grace. I hope that game's good.
I hope so too, because I'll be reviewing it for NWR. So make sure to check it out in a week or two when it comes out.
I was just going to say, Ayana says it's really good, that girl on Twitter.
Oh, that's good. The more people who say it's good, the more confident I feel. So, so make sure to check out that review on NintendoWorldReport.com. And you can follow me at Filtered Gamer, or you can follow the podcast at The Thirsty Mage. And I'm sure we're all connected. So if you want to find anybody, it's usually through there. So So I want to thank everyone for listening to our love fest for Akitoshi Kawazu and the Saga series. And I'm happy that you were able to make it, Jonathan, and provide some classic Kawazu, and Guillaume is sharing the Final Fantasy Legend 2, and for Neil joining us for the Saga 3 review. So
yeah,
happy to have everyone listen, and we'll see everyone out at the next Thirsty Mage.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.